my math is horribly inadequate for what I'm trying to do, but we'll be talking about how to get from Christ to Muhammad, and just giving you an overview of basically 30, from about the year 30 to about the year 600, shortly thereafter. And sort of laying out the contours. Since in this class there's not a textbook, all of the readings are primary source readings, that means that it creates a certain pressure on me to give you the context for everything. So tonight what we'll do is sort of give an overview of the whole period. It also means that tonight you'll be hearing more of me, and there'll be less discussion just by virtue of the fact that we haven't read anything for tonight. I feel for the poor guys in America who had to endure 4 hours of this. And I'm cutting this back. This will be interesting because I didn't quite finish everything in the 4 hours, so I'll be doing some definite trimming as we go. But to start off, the first topic could be called how the church grew, or how to conquer an empire without even trying. 30 to 300 AD. And in the, I think oftentimes the way the history of the early church is portrayed, persecution plays a major role in the story of the church. Tertullian's famous statement, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." In fact, persecution was probably a relatively minor factor in the growth of the church. Not irrelevant, but it was not the big factor in the growth of the early church. Really, one could argue that the plague or plagues were as important a factor in the growth of the church as persecution. Today, we oftentimes, when you think of how the church grows, what do you think of? Right, evangelism, missions. That's when you look at the history of the early church, you find very few missionaries, very few people going off and doing what we would recognize as missions. Conversion stories such as Justin Martyr tells how he was converted by an old man whom he met walking by the sea. You don't hear lots of missionary stories. You do have some, such as Gregory of Pontus in Cappadocia, modern-day Turkey, otherwise known as Gregory Thaumaturgus, Gregory the Wonder Worker. He was very instrumental in planting a large number of churches in that region, and miracles were an important part. That's why he got the name Thaumaturgus, Wonder Worker. And miracles are a common feature in early Christian narratives of how people became Christians. One example is when Gregory, there was a flood threatening a town where he was, and he planted his staff by the riverbank and commanded the waters to stop there. And they did. And the story is told that his staff sprouted and became a tree. One sometimes wonders, how do you handle all these stories? Because there are so many of them. One thing to remember is James says that Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. And he prayed to God that it would not rain, and it didn't. So James seems to indicate that we shouldn't be surprised when God answers our prayers in remarkable ways. It's hard to evaluate all the claims. After all, how many times did the local bishop plant his staff by the bank of the river and nothing happened? The river kept coming. So we don't know, and certainly there's no indication of quite as remarkable miracles as we don't have stories of every handkerchief going forth from one of these people, everybody's getting healed right and left of it. So you don't have quite the same sorts of miracles that you have in the Book of Acts, but nonetheless you do have a significant number of remarkable remarkable providences, whatever word you want to use for it, they seem to have been very instrumental in the life of the early church. And, of course, one thing to remember is that every religion has had its wonder workers. So it's, in that sense, this isn't necessarily something that's totally unique to Christianity. You think of Simon Magus and others in the ancient world who had, they had, so in that sense, it's not unheard of. But persecution was a factor. But there were very specific times. So, for instance, Domitian, who was emperor from 81 to 96, he clearly considered Christianity to be a crime against the state because Christians would not recognize him as Lord. And so he apparently tried to kill all the remaining relatives of Jesus, James, for instance. He banished John to Patmos. Likewise, Trajan, from 98 to 117, did not, he did not approve of seeking out Christians. We have a letter from Trajan where he's instructing one of his governors and says, don't seek them out, it's not worth your time, but if they're accused of being a Christian, you should investigate, because it's illegal, and we don't want to let criminals running around, go around without being punished. And so it's during Trajan's reign that Simeon, the bishop of Jerusalem, was accused by the Jews and crucified in around the year 107, about the same time Ignatius of Antioch was martyred. But generally, persecutions throughout the Roman Empire focused on the bishops. The idea was that if you knock out the leaders, you'll knock out the movement. Yes, it involved a misunderstanding of the nature of Christianity. Christianity did not depend upon the bishops in the same way that the pagan religions depended upon their priests. And so that's why Roman persecution was generally ineffective. There were some exceptions to that. In Lyon, in 177, even slaves and children were killed for their faith. The early 3rd century saw persecution in Egypt and Carthage that reached ordinary Christians. Another wave in the decade of the 250s under Decius. When Decius issued a proclamation that all residents of the Roman Empire had to be had to offer sacrifices to the emperor, not just Christians. You got a ticket, basically. You got a statement saying this person has done the sacrifice. And archaeology has turned up all sorts of these little tickets from people who weren't Christians, or hadn't, like if there was a pagan priestess, and obviously nobody would have assumed that she was a Christian, but she had fulfilled the emperor's bidding. Because Decius's objection was not just to Christianity, his objection was to anything that gets in the way of the imperial cult. We'll see in a few minutes why that is. Actually, if I don't think about what I'm cutting out later on, I need to tell you this now. The reason why Decius is so insistent upon the imperial cult is because Decius is, in the decade of the 250s, is in the middle of the biggest crisis of imperial Rome. Because during the middle of the 3rd century, you have about 100 years from roughly 200, roughly 300, basically from Marcus Aurelius, one of the famous Roman emperors of who dies around 180, I think it is, until Diocletian, who takes the throne in 280, where you have no emperor reigns for more than 20 years. You have 27 emperors in 100 years. 27 emperors. That's an average of under 4 years per emperor. And by the year 235, these emperors are all soldiers. Septimius Severus was Roman emperor at the turn of the century, 193 to 211, I believe he was. He had basically established the policy that the army gets to decide who the next emperor is. And up until that point, the emperors had largely come from the senatorial class. They were Italians. They had strong ties to Rome. Rome is their city. After this, not so much. You have emperors who come from the Balkans. You have Philip the Arab, No, he probably wasn't an Arab. He probably had Italian family connections. But you have provincials who don't have any strong ties to Rome. They are generals who have been leading the troops, and the troops like them, and so they don't like what's going on in Rome. And so you have just emperor after emperor lasting for 6 months, 2 years, maybe if they're doing well, 7 years, and then they're assassinated. As I was looking through the lists of emperors, I'll confess, I did not have time to read every single one of the 27 emperors in the biographies, but I couldn't come across a single one who died of a natural death. They were all assassinated, or some of them were killed in battle. But it gets awfully suspicious, because how on earth did the enemy troops get so close? You know, there are some where it's very clear it was enemy troops that killed them, but far more common was, this battle isn't going so well, let's kill the emperor. So, in that context, the imperial cult is not faring so well. Saying that the emperor is God, it's awfully hard to say this guy's a god, when just 6 months ago, he was a provincial general who had no connections to Rome, and now he's suddenly God? Sorry, you're not going to convince me. So Decius is trying desperately in order to restore some sort of unity to the Roman Empire, and the way you restore unity to the Roman Empire is through the Roman cult. Polytheism, basically the way polytheism maintains its political hold on its people is by saying you can worship any god you want to, so long as you also either worship or at least bow down to the king. You see this in Cyrus, his edict when he says go back and rebuild your temple, just make sure you pray for me. He didn't say you have to worship me, but he did say you have to pray for me. And you see this regularly throughout the Persian emperors. Polytheism says you can have your own religion, that's fine, but you have your religion and you also have me. I'm the emperor, you need to serve me. And that's where Christians were willing to serve the emperor in outward terms, but they were not willing to offer sacrifices for the emperor. Or to the emperor, and to the imperial cult, and so we'll talk about what happens in that, because it's in that Decius's persecution where you have Cyprian hid from persecution and was accused of being unwilling to lay down his life for Christ. His response was that the martyr's crown comes by the grace of God and cannot be gained before the appointed hour. He counseled moderation in how to handle people who had lapsed, but Donatus, man of Donatus, objected, and the Donatists wound up becoming the Donatist schism, where they insisted that if you offered sacrifices to the emperor, then God may forgive you, but the church can't. And so you may never be restored to the Christian church. Cyprian argued you should be permitted to return, and they basically said, yeah, you coward, what do you know? Well, a few years later, Cyprian got his chance to try it again, and this time he was martyred in the next wave of persecution in 258. But persecution didn't work. And in the reign of Gallienus, who was emperor from 260 to 268, Christianity was treated as a legal religion. And for the next generation, for 40 years, there was no significant persecution of Christians. Christians went on building church buildings. This is where persecution is significant, but it doesn't get in the way of your daily life. The main thing that you would be thinking about as a Christian is someday, you know, there may come a day, maybe in my life, maybe in my children's life, where another persecution will crop up. You may or may not see it in your life where you live. But the reason why persecution is important for the early church, the reason why everybody thinks, oh, this was the big thing, is because they talk about it so much, because you always have to be ready. The day may come when the emperor will knock on your door in the person of his soldiers and say, you have to sacrifice. What will you do when that day comes? And particularly, as we're talking to ministerial trainees this morning, saying, for them, if you want to become a clergyman, you'll be the target. It's bishops who get martyred. Yes, occasionally it comes down to the lay level. And that's where it comes down to the lay level is rarely in the imperial persecution. It's rather, it's in the local persecutions when the plague comes, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, when the plague comes and the Christians get blamed for it. Or when there's a famine and the Christians get blamed for it, a riot starts, some Christians wind up getting killed. It's, you know, it's not something that the emperor was looking for, but on the other hand, the emperor is not going to complain about it either. Because after all, Christianity is not a legal religion, and so there's no reason why he should care what happens to you because you were practicing something that wasn't legal. The main persecution comes when Diocletian... This is sort of the big persecution in 303-304 when Diocletian attempted to establish uniformity in the empire. Just to give a brief, because it's going to be important for the rest of the class to understand what Diocletian does. Diocletian is a major reformer. The Roman Empire from Augustus in 31 BC to 284 with Diocletian, the Roman Empire is, at least in theory, ruled by a single emperor who is the Augustus. Every now and then somebody gets the bright idea that this thing's too big for me, so they split up between, usually your brother or your son takes the other half. But Augustus rules the whole empire. The problem over the last 100 years that Diocletian sees is partly the problem of succession. Who's going to rule when you're gone? And it's partly the problem of administering this vast empire that there's no way that you can cover. And so Diocletian comes up with the it's called the Tetrarchy. There is an Augustus and a Caesar for each half of the empire. Augustus being the title of the emperor, Caesar being the title of the junior, sort of the heir apparent. And so Diocletian establishes the Tetrarchy where each Augustus is autonomous. I mean, he doesn't have to ask permission for anything. Usually then the Caesar, for instance, by this time Rome is no longer the capital from the 3rd century. The emperors are usually residing in Milan or in Trier, up in modern-day Germany. So the imperial residence has moved, the western residence, Milan or Trier, or in the east, Thessalonica or Nicomedia in modern-day Turkey, Thessalonica in modern-day Greece. So that's where the emperor usually now resides in Milan in the west, Nicomedia in the east, and then the Caesar will be up in Trier, taking care of the modern day France, basically the northern provinces, and the other Caesar usually is in Syria, Antioch, or down in Alexandria, taking care of the southern provinces in the east. So basically, it's a way of providing for administrative reform in order to consolidate and basically bring peace and stability to an empire that has been fragmented for a century. Diocletian also sees persecuting Christians as, again, like Decius had, as a way of bringing administrative unity and imperial unity to the empire, largely because the Christian church is getting in the way of the emperor as the supreme patron. Now, for those of you who have been in the Economics and the Household of God study, you've seen a little bit about what patronage means in the Roman world. Patronage, it's, and actually, if you want to understand patronage, think of the Godfather. Think of all the mafia movies you've ever seen. That's what patronage is. The difference being, the mafia exists today in modern states where there are police forces. In ancient Rome, there was no police force, so basically, you protect your own, and it's not a perfect illustration, but it works. Patrons are the emperor is the supreme patron, and if in your daily life the way that you're protected, the way that you can do business, the way that you are able to function in Roman society is because your patron watches out for you and you do the bidding of your patron in order to keep him happy. Now, what's happening in the third century is that Christianity is growing by leaps and bounds, and bishops are becoming patrons. Because after all, what does a patron do? Well, one of the things a patron does is mediate disputes. Bishops mediate disputes for Christians. Patrons provide provide for the general welfare of their clients, of their dependents. What do bishops do? The diaconal, what we would call sort of the diaconal, you know, mercy ministry of the church, is providing for poor Christians. So you have this alternate system of patronage that's being established not under imperial control. And what's the other factor is, the Roman bureaucracy, they were very much afraid of local bureaucrats gaining too much power. So that's why they moved them around so much. That's why, as you go through the book of Luke and the book of Acts, you don't see the same names popping up all the time. It's why Paul deals with both Felix and Festus, because we don't want these guys hanging around too long, building up too much of a power base. We need to move them along. But Rome can't move bishops. Bishops are appointed by the church. And so, therefore, bishops wind up becoming the administrative, in fact, in many cities, where especially as the Roman bureaucracy is breaking down, the bishops are providing the cohesiveness in the cities. So that's where the emperors take the view of at least Diocletian and his Caesar Galerius take the view that we need to stomp these Christians out, and so that's where the biggest persecution. This is the first time that it's clear that there were thousands of Christians being killed. Most previous persecutions, there had been bishops were the main targets, or you get local sort of localized persecutions where maybe a few hundred, a few dozen get killed. Here in the Diocletian persecution, the smallest estimate is 2,000, and it's probably a whole lot higher than that, because it was a systematic attempt to stamp out Christianity. But by that point, it was a futile effort, because by that point, estimates are there were perhaps 5 to 6 million Christians. And you're not going to succeed at killing them all. Basically, Christianity saw a 40% growth rate per decade between the time of Christ and the time of Constantine. That's a rough average. Obviously, some decades it would have been higher, some decades it would have been lower. But in order to get from the 3,000 at the day of Pentecost to the roughly 6 million by the time of Constantine, you need about a 40% growth rate per decade. Now, what that means is that, and I think in my handout I've given you what that chart would look like, and in order to get to the number 6 million in the year 300, you have to start with 1,000. We know from the book of Acts there were more than 1,000, but nonetheless, Rodney Stark is a sociologist who's done this, and he's just basically showing, he's not saying this is exact, these were the numbers of Christians, he's simply saying if you started with only 1,000 in the year 40, you would still wind up with 6 million by the time you get to 300 if you have an exact 40% per decade, which obviously is not exact. Incidentally, there is another new religious movement that has done exactly this for more than a century. Do you know who it is? the Mormons. 43% per decade for the last century. So it can be done. And actually, Stark points to this and points out that Mormon growth does not happen through their door-to-door stuff. They get one convert for 1,000 times they knock on the door. But if they arrange for a meeting between a Mormon missionary and your friend in your home, 50%. That's why you don't see quite as many Mormons knocking on doors lately. But then think back to the book of Acts. Who is it who's getting converted? Jews? God-fearers. In other words, Gentiles have been hanging around Jews. When Paul goes to Athens and does a cold call evangelistic sermon, it doesn't get much. So that's where... that's where the early Christian church was overwhelmingly Jewish. Jews, and again, estimates are vary, but there may have been as many as 7 million Jews in the time of Augustus. And part of the way they do these things is by names, naming practices, and obviously you have a variety of factors that go into it. But there only seemed to be about 3 to 4 million Jews by the time of Constantine. And yes, I'm sure the stomping out of Jerusalem in 70 AD and then again in 135 AD, probably there were a lot of Jews who died in that. That makes sense. But it doesn't explain how you get so few Jews. Unless you say that an awful lot of these Jews are now Christians. Again, look at the book of Acts. Where does Christianity spread and grow? Christianity spreads and grows, at least in the book of Acts, in the cities of Asia Minor, where Judaism had already taken root. It does well in the cities of Macedonia and Greece, where there was already a Jewish presence. Doesn't do well in totally Gentile Athens. It's spreading in Rome. It does well in Alexandria. Now, in the book of Acts, we don't hear much about what's going on eastward, but of course, in the Persian Empire, the Parthians, there was a large Jewish presence there, and surprise, surprise, Persia sees very large numbers of Christian converts. The first Christian nation. Anybody know? First Christian nation wasn't Rome.
Assyria?
It's actually cool. I mean, it's the same region formerly known as Assyria. If you had gotten this, I would have been stunned. But Adiabene. it's. whose capital city was actually one of the most important cities in. The early church. And it's probably the most important city in the history of Christianity that you've never heard of. Maybe you have. Some of you, maybe. Edessa?
Yeah.
Edessa is just outside of the Roman Empire. It's occasionally under Roman control. It's also occasionally under Persian control. It's also occasionally various other things. But Adiabene was a pro-Jewish state on the borders of Rome. Which, in fact, in the Roman attack in AD 70, it was because of concerns that Adiabene might come to the aid of the Jewish rebels in Judea. And as late as the 5th century, as John Chrysostom is preaching in Constantinople, he preaches regularly against people going back to Judaism. Now, can you imagine me preaching to you saying, don't go back to Judaism? I mean, even when I was preaching through Hebrews, I wasn't saying, I mean, even though that's sort of the message of Hebrews, I wasn't saying to you, don't go back to Judaism, because quite frankly, I wasn't concerned about that. Chrysostom was, because in the 5th century, you still have Christians going back to Judaism. Because, quite frankly,
there's still a strong relationship between the church and the synagogue. There's still a there's a recognition that we have Jewish roots here. Okay, so that's basically the Jewish connection. Church is growing amongst Jewish and Jewish-related peoples, and then branching out to Gentiles from that center. I said at the beginning that plague would be as important as persecution in the growth of the church. Why do you suppose plague was important in the growth of the church?
Well, the standard response in the Roman Empire when the plague came was to flee.
Yes.
But the Christians didn't. They took around and cared for the sick, and therefore they raised up a generation that was either immune to the plague or, you know, it got through it.
Yeah. Ever heard of Galen, famous Roman physician? Has given us a very detailed description of every disease he ever encountered, and has given us a very sketchy account of the plague that hit Rome in 255. The reason being that Galen never saw anyone who had the plague and had to rely on secondhand accounts, because he had no intention of helping people who had plague. So, the two major plagues. Now, you may recall that the persecutions hit, two of the major persecutions happened towards the end of the 2nd century and then in the middle of the 3rd century. The two major plagues hit just before that. Smallpox hit the Roman Empire roughly 165, and about a quarter to a third of the Roman Empire seems to have been wiped out. The second plague came between 251 and 260. Obviously, they don't just come in one year and then disappear. So when these ranges are, this was the range of years when it was making the rounds of the empire. Appears to be measles the second time. Again, wiped out roughly 30, if not more, percent of the Roman Empire. Largely because this was the first time these diseases had ever hit the empire. And when smallpox and measles hits for the first time, they can be very devastating. And so now, part of the way plague works for the advantage of the Christian church is simply because it kills more pagans than Christians. Now, what's your best chance if you catch smallpox? What's your best chance for survival, doctor? Not so much in the Roman Empire. What's your best chance for survival if you catch smallpox? It's actually still true today, if you don't have a doctor nearby.
You have a cow herder?
No.
Caring Christian brethren.
Wouldn't have to be Christian. I mean, but yes, one of the best ways to survive, and this goes for any major disease like this, one of the best ways to survive is to simply have somebody take care of you. And so that's where, even today, you can cut the mortality rate by two-thirds by simple nursing, you know, providing fluids and keeping somebody warm. So that means the pagan death rate, if you take an overall death rate of 30%, the pagan death rate is 31%, the Christian death rate is 10%. Add on to that the fact that these diseases hit pregnant and nursing women the hardest, and the Christian birth rate in the next generation soars, and the pagan birth rate falls. So, and that's just without, without even talking about the theological and ecclesiological implications of this. Also, Christians tended to nurse and provide for non-Christians who were connected to their. So, for instance, if your unbelieving husband, and which, quite frankly, given the gender ratios of those days, that's more likely the way it's going to be. If your unbelieving husband comes down with it, you'll take care of him. Or, for that matter, if you and your unbelieving husband come down with it, there'll be a deacon who comes by and cares for the two of you together. And so you see non-Christians looking at Christians and saying, "My goodness, these people care about each other. They're willing to endure all sorts of things for each other."
And you see that exhibition of Christian love demonstrated before the watching world. Give you the example of Antioch. I've already said there's a Persian Empire right here, which I should have drawn the map to let you see more of it. Antioch is really... I pity the city of Antioch. It's in a very bad location if peace and tranquility is what you're looking for. It's basically the crossroads of empire. And everybody wants to control Antioch. So Antioch is also a city of 2 square miles. So to let you think about that, 2 square miles, not very big, with 150,000 people, which means that's 117 people per acre. Okay, right now we're sitting on a piece of ground that's 10 acres. And so imagine 1,000 people living on this piece of property right here. 1,000 people. Now, the only U.S. city that can even come close to that, or portion of a U.S. city, is Manhattan. Manhattan has 100 per acre, and Manhattan is mostly vertical. In Antioch, if you get vertical, you're dead. In those days, a four or five story building is likely going to come crashing down within a decade because there'll be an earthquake. So cities are crammed full, yet itty bitty apartments with people crammed together, narrow streets, filthy, stinky, not a very pleasant environment. Not to mention 18 different ethnic groups. And this, again, it's the intersection of nations. And each ethnic group has its own separate part of the city. In a span of 600 years, more or less the period we're looking at, Antioch suffered 13 sieges, 11 successful, 5 included sacking and pillaging, 4 fires that burned the whole city down, plus numerous others, 6 major riots in which hundreds die, numerous others and only a few, 8 massive earthquakes in which huge numbers died, hundreds of minor earthquakes, geologically not a great place to live, 3 killer epidemics, 2 of which we've already spoken of, plus others in which less than 25% of the population died. Yes. So in other words, 5 serious famines. In other words, 1 major catastrophe every 15 years.
Sounds almost as bad as California.
Why do people want to live there?
Oh, good question. Well, because it's a very good location. You know, everybody wants that location.
So it has irregular villages. What would make it so important to stay there?
Well, for one, it's where you're from, and oftentimes it's where you can find work compared to, and so yeah. And so in that sense, yeah, it looks, yeah, every 15 years, you're likely to die. But it's a key location, and for that, I mean, the emperor wants it. In terms of farming, in terms of the region is a strategic region. And but really, part of it is, it's not like you could go someplace else and expect a much easier life. I use Antioch; it's only slightly an extreme example. Other cities don't get sacked and pillaged quite as often. Although, quite frankly, in this region, don't count on it. Any city is going to the reason why they live there is, where else are you going to go? Because that's just life in the ancient world, particularly more or less on the frontier, which is where pretty much anything from the Mediterranean to the Persian plateau is going to be hotly contested. The Tigris and Euphrates rivers do not form a natural barrier. You can't defend them permanently. Really, there's only twice in human history has this region ever been under a single power. First, it was Cyrus who brought back in the 6th century BC, who brought this whole region under Persian control, and for 200 years it remained between Cyrus and Darius, up to Alexander the Great. This whole region was under a single control. Alexander the Great takes over the Persian Empire and takes up his residence in Babylon. I mean, Alexander was not he was simply taking over the Persian Empire. He was not starting something from scratch. And then after his death, Alexander's empire falls apart, and from that day, for nearly 1,000 years, this region there's an ever-shifting border moving from the Mediterranean to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, basically up to the Persian plateau. The borders are constantly shifting back and forth because there's no natural boundary that you can say, yeah, here we stand, you're not going to take this. Yes, I will. It's not. So basically for at this point, it's been if you take this up to 600 AD, it's been for 800 years or so that this has been a contested borderlands. But that's where Christianity offered hope. And part of it was in Christian doctrine that offered salvation and pointed beyond, basically pointed to the resurrection. But also it brought a new culture. And crucial in that word culture is the word cult. In the ancient world, you're not going to talk about culture without talking about religion. That's what culture means. Christian theology was more effective at explaining plagues and providing courage in the face of death. And its ecclesiology was better at mobilizing human resources for charity. Dionysius of Alexandria, Bishop of Alexandria, at the time of the plagues of the 250s, said, "Most of our brother Christians showed unbounded love and loyalty. Heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ. And with them departed this life serenely happy. For they were infected by others with the disease, drawing on themselves the sickness of their neighbors. Many, in nursing and curing others, transferred their death to themselves and died in their stead, the equal of martyrdom. The heathen behaved in the very opposite way. At the first onset of the disease, they pushed the sufferers away and fled from their dearest, throwing them into the roads before they were dead and treated unburied corpses as dirt, hoping thereby to avert the spread and contagion of the fatal disease. But do it they might, they found it difficult to escape." So basically, and he also goes on to talk about this sort of remarkable way in which Christians seem to walk oftentimes untouched by disease in caring for the sick. Yes, here he talks about those who died, but those who came down with the disease and did not die then became immune to it and were basically able to care for the need. And that's where they seem truly like wonder workers in their ability to care for those who were sick. Also, I should point to the importance of women in early Christian growth. There was a study of 600 pagan families that showed that only six had raised more than one daughter. In Rome, the practice was if after the first daughter, you would take all further daughters and expose them and infanticide, basically let them die. We have a letter from a husband to his wife. It's a very touching letter. He's on a business trip and he writes home to his wife who's pregnant and it shows his affection for her and then he makes a passing reference to, I'm not going to be home in time for the baby to be born. If it's a boy, keep it. If it's a girl, expose it. Discard it is his word. Basically, that's what would generally happen to any beyond the first daughter. Christianity, and so in Roman culture, Roman society, the ratio was 140 men for every 100 women. You can imagine why homosexuality, prostitution, things like that are a problem. There aren't enough women to go around. part of it's also part of the reason for the practice is because with as many men dying in battle as Rome expected, you don't want too many women. So that was part of the rationale. But Christianity rejected that. And partly because of that, Christians went out and found the foundlings and raised them as their own daughters. Christians had larger families. Again, you can see lots of reasons why Christian growth is coming in all sorts of ways beyond just... And quite frankly, missionary marriage was far more common than bishops liked. Christian sermons against missionary dating, to use our term for it, are so common that it's convinced historians that it must have been a major problem, because you don't preach about something that isn't happening. And so the fervor with which the fathers denounced marrying pagans indicates it was a problem. Part of it is Roman law required all women in the senatorial class to marry, and all men for that matter. So if you are in the senatorial class, you must marry in order to propagate the ruling class of Rome. And so if you're a Christian woman, and in the Christian church, for a ballpark, we're pretty certain about the 140 to 100 ratio for men to women in the Roman Empire. The Christian church seems to have been the opposite, roughly 140 women for every 100 men, something like that. Could have even been higher. So if you're a Christian woman and you're in the senatorial class, you have to marry. And there are no Christian men to marry. So, we'll encounter some of the stories about what did Christian women do in that situation. In many cases, they married the man that their father said you're going to marry. And in many of these cases, these men wound up becoming Christians. In other cases, they didn't. It just depended. But we'll run into some of the more remarkable women. Unfortunately, we don't get to hear about all of them. But as we go along, any questions?
So, Cyprian went by quickly. He was a bishop.
Mm-hmm.
Where?
In Carthage, in North Africa. So we'll at this point, I mean, I'm giving you the quick overview tonight. Actually, we're actually going to come back to virtually everything when we come back to looking at the sources. So basically, this is designed to sort of give you here's the lay of the land. So if it seems like an awful lot of material for a couple hours, it is. So, any questions about what we've covered thus far?
When they went off to the vessel merchants or something, or instead of like a monastery or something, women who didn't want to marry.
We'll come to that. Oh yeah, we'll have all sorts of fun with that. That's part two, because we've gotten from 30 to 300, and now we've got part two. How do you get from 300 to 600? So I just want to check and see if there's any questions here. I mentioned Diocletian. He was the emperor who established the Tetrarchy, the two Augusti and the two Caesars. Diocletian, basically, the way you might think immediately, what do you think of this system? Having two emperors and the sort of the two junior emperors, so the emperors in waiting. What do you think would be some of the challenges that would arise from that sort of system?
Being satisfied with your half of the empire?
Oh, yeah. Being satisfied with your half of the empire. And?
Being satisfied to be the Caesar instead of the Augustus.
Exactly. So, that's... it's now, the thing is, it's... oh, thank you. It's true. Diocletian's reforms work. At least, they work better than the old single Augustus model. Augustus... It had worked well to have sort of the senatorial elitist emperor for a couple hundred years, but by the 3rd century, it's just not working. So Diocletian's reforms are sort of moderately effective at bringing stability, and indeed it sets up the model for the later Roman Empire, and it continues with considerable success. So it's in this system. Diocletian is actually his system. He actually follows his own system. He's the absolute worst emperor as far as Christians are concerned because of his persecution, you know, killing thousands of them. But in terms of somebody who actually follows his own system, Diocletian retires. He abdicates in 305 A.D. And hands off the empire to, at least the eastern half of the empire where he was ruling, to Galerius in 305, retires to the Croatian coast, and lives his last decade in peace and tranquility, and dies at a happy old age. So, it worked! And Diocletian followed his own system, and although, quite frankly, by the time he dies in 316, he may not have been quite so happy with what he was hearing about, but because what was happening was utter chaos, as Constantine has been battling for the succession in the West. So, Constantine's father, Constantius, was the first Caesar in the West, under Maximianus Herculius. Constantine, in fact, was raised in the East as a hostage under Galerius, the Eastern Emperor, in order to ensure his father's good behavior. After all, one of the ways in which you can ensure good behavior across between the two Augusti and the two Caesars is either marrying off, if you marry your daughter to the Caesar over there, then he better do well, or by handing over sons as hostages. And so Constantine grew up in the East under Galerius, and then went on to serve with his father in the West, became Caesar in the West in 306. At the death of his father, the army proclaimed him Augustus. And this goes back to that problem, who gets to proclaim who's who? Diocletian had said, it's the Augustus who gets to proclaim the next Caesar, and then that Caesar becomes Augustus when the Augustus dies, and then as the new Augustus, he gets to appoint the new Caesar. So it's supposed to take it out of the army's hands and put it into the hands of the emperor. Of course, the army wasn't entirely happy with that, and so that's why when Constantius dies, the army proclaims Constantine Augustus, and from 306 to 312, he is battling for control of the West, finally seizes control at the Battle of Milvian Bridge in 312, which is the famous episode where he sees the visions saying, in this sign, conquer, and puts the sign of the cross on his army's shields, and they go on to conquer, and so he becomes a Christian. The Eastern Emperor Licinius, by that time, is not pleased with this behavior. The Edict of Milan, which provided recognition for Christianity as a legal religion, was actually a joint endeavor between Constantine and Licinius, but Licinius revoked it 8 years later in the East and renewed the persecution of the Christians. Many historians believe that Licinius did this in order to provoke Constantine to come attack him in the East, because Licinius did not think that he could beat Constantine in the West, But he thought that if he could lure Constantine into the east, he could defeat him there. Nice try, didn't work. Constantine defeated Licinius. Constantine becomes, he thinks of himself as the new David. He thinks of himself as the new Moses. He thinks of himself as the new Joshua, as the one who is going to bring the empire, basically bring Romanity and Christianity together. Christianity becomes the sort of the new vision of what is going to hold the Roman Empire together, what is going to make the Roman Empire triumph. And so Constantine's vision is Constantine's vision is basically of a of moving from political universalism to cultural universalism. Cyrus had established political universalism in this region. In other words, one emperor, Cyrus, ruling over all the regions from Persia to throughout the Middle East, Turkey, into Greece, Egypt, the whole region. Cyrus had established his political rule, but as a polytheist, he didn't care who you worshipped so long as you acknowledged him as emperor. Constantine moves towards cultural universalism. And part of it is, if you're convinced that there is one God, and that everybody is supposed to worship this one God, then remember, at the heart of culture is cult, worship. Cultural universalism is not far behind. Now, monotheism is not necessarily culturally universalist. What's an example of a monotheism that is not a cultural universalism?
Judaism.
Right. Judaism is very nationalistic. Yes, there's only one God, but he's our God. And if you want to worship him, you have to become one of us. And quite frankly, at this period of time, if you become a Jew, you may not refer to Yahweh as the God of our fathers. Because he's not. He's the God of your fathers, if you're a Gentile convert. The way you pray is you pray to the God of your fathers, namely the Jews' fathers. So converting to Judaism at this time is not something that makes you really... I mean, you remain sort of an outsider at your... In this period now we're talking about after the destruction of the temple, after the real split between Judaism and Christianity, as Judaism becomes less and less interested in converting people and more interested in they're still interested in regaining their temple and their culture in Judea. And in fact, it is Constantine's nephew who will nearly do that. Constantine's nephew is oftentimes known as Julian the Apostate. After Constantine's death, he divided his empire amongst his three sons, or he didn't divide, he died. His sons killed off most of their cousins, except for Julian. Why they leave him alive, I don't know. And divided up the empire amongst the three of them. Within 13 years, they had fought each other into the ground, and the only one left of the three was the Arian. There were two Orthodox brothers, and the third guy was Arian. The Arian was the one that defeated both his other brothers, took the whole empire. All of that's coming up later. Julian is the one who winds up with the throne after his cousins all die, and Julian tries to establish a new sort of cultural universalism based on polytheism. Polytheism makes it difficult to have a cultural universalism because everybody has to worship many gods.
The same many gods?
So yeah, well, so because so in order to have that's why he tries to bring together the worship of the sun, which had been a common one of the major deities of Roman culture, and bring that together with Mithraism, which was some kind of a strange blending of Buddhism and Persian religion and various Roman and Egyptian. It's sort of a perfect hybrid for Rome. But it basically, and because, and again, patronage is going to keep coming back over and over again. With the bishops having so much control in throughout the Roman Empire, Julian has to find other sources of to sort of where he's able to find support. So he tries to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And there are stories that in all sorts of different sources about this fire that kept burning people up while they were trying to work on building the temple. Again, what do you do with it? It's interesting stories. Were they just made up? Or, you know, for whatever reason, though, Julian calls a halt to the construction and ceases trying to build and embarks on an invasion of the Persian Empire. All throughout Roman history, Rome and Persia are always at odds, and it's very rare to find a Roman emperor invading Persia. It never turns out well. But Julian is convinced that in order to restore the glory of pagan Rome, he needs a Julius Caesar type victory, and so or an Alexander the Great type victory, and so he comes marching into Persia, where he dies, bringing his 18-month rule to an end. If he had had more time, he might have succeeded. Though the challenge was. He's caught his uncle's vision. He's caught Constantine's vision of this sort of cultural universalism, but he's trying to find a pagan polytheist way of bringing Rome together in this new sort of universal vision. So he writes letters to the leading priests in the region, urging them to take up works of charity like Christian bishops. The problem is, pagan priests didn't want to have anything to do with the poor. That wasn't part of their job description. What's interesting is, Julian writes to them and says to them, this is part of the vision of our Roman forefathers. This is something that has always... We've lost sight of our Roman way of caring for the poor, which is through our pagan temples. He tries to take, basically... Christian, again, Constantine was trying to wed Christianity and Romanity. What it means to be Christian, what it means to be Roman. Julian is saying, okay, fine, I'll take that, but I want a pagan version of what it means to be Roman, but I want to bring in some of these Christian ideas, Christian ecclesiology, and add it to my pagan Neoplatonic background. Odds are it would have failed anyway. The Christian church had become simply too powerful. Although Julian's strategy had... Well, one thing he had going for him was... One of the things he did was... This is 361 to 363 when he's in power. This is the very heart, the very center of the Nicene controversy, the Arian controversy over Trinitarian orthodoxy. And one of Julian's brilliant strategies is he sends everybody home. Athanasius was an exile when he took the throne. He sends Athanasius home. Many Arian bishops were in exile. He sends them home. He says, everybody go home. Fight amongst yourselves. Don't bother me. His idea is if we let the Arians and the Nicene party fight each other long enough, they'll destroy each other and paganism can rule again. Although... Just about 6 months after Athanasius gets back to Alexandria, Julian realizes that letting Athanasius get near Alexandria is a really bad idea. Exiles him again. So in Julian, we see the last-ditch attempt of paganism in its attempt to regain power in the Roman world. By the time you get to... Another century later, second half of the 5th century, Christianity is firmly entrenched. And I've given you there the number 4 from Constantine to Mohammed. This is from Garth Fowden's Empire to Commonwealth, Consequences of Monotheism in Late Antiquity. He tells the story of, in the life of St. Daniel the Stylite, who lived atop a pillar by the Bosporus in the second half of the 5th century. We read how the Byzantine Emperor Leo I, around the year 470, received a visit from Gobazes, king of Lazica. Lazica is near Armenia. It's, well, that map's too small. You can't see a thing over there. But it's in between the Caspian and the Black Seas. Lazica had been a tributary state to Persia, but now this is sort of the key transition moment when they are coming more under Roman authority. It was a Christian area like Armenia. It was a Christian area, but it had been more connected to Persia. Leo took Gobazes along with him to meet the holy man, Daniel the Stylite. When he saw this strange sight, Gobazes threw himself on his face and said, "I thank thee, heavenly king, that by means of an earthly king thou hast deemed me worthy to behold great mysteries, for never before in this world have I seen anything of this kind." What has he seen? He has seen a man sitting on top of a pillar. Okay. Now, of course, a man who has been sitting on top of that pillar for, at this point, roughly 20 years, and has not come down in 20 years. And these kings had a point in dispute touching Roman policy, and they laid the whole matter open to the servant of God, and through the mediation of the holy man, they agreed upon a treaty which satisfied the claims of each. After this, the emperor returned to the city and dismissed Gobazes to his native land, and when the latter reached his own country, he related to all his folk what he had seen. Consequently, the men who later on came up from Lazica to the city invariably went up to Daniel. Gobazes himself, too, wrote to the holy man and besought his prayers, and never ceased doing so to the end of his life. Okay. What do you see in that story? What's... anything catch your attention? We'll talk later about why are guys sitting on pillars, but...
He saw him as a servant of God.
Right. What's going on here?
Mediation all seems to be kind of a foreign way of settling disputes. Absolutely amazing that they can go through arbitration instead of fighting it out.
This is the way you do it. I mean, if you can find a way of avoiding fighting it out, you want to do that. What's remarkable is who do they pick for their mediator?
Yeah, it's not a bishop or anybody in temporal power. It's a holy man who's sitting on a pole off the desk.
Right. Why would the Roman emperor, and if you think about this, 200 years before, in the days of Diocletian, going to a guy sitting on a pillar? Just a few miles outside of Constantinople. These Stylites and desert monks and such, they weren't disappearing out into the middle of nowhere so nobody could find them. They wind up in places where they can be found, and this is precisely why. Because this is... But there is a new... Really, we talked about patronage. This is precisely the sort of thing that Julian was most afraid of. The Christian Church has become... it's not even the institutional church. It's this holy man is resolving disputes between an emperor and the Lazican king precisely because the Lazican king believes he's able to trust Daniel the Stylite. That Daniel the Stylite is not so much in the grip of the Byzantine emperor that he is somehow going to be simply interested in Roman policy. He sees this holy man as a true arbiter. And so Fowden points out that that one of the defining characteristics of late antiquity was its conviction that knowledge of the one God both justifies the exercise of imperial power and makes it more effective. And this is where... this is where Constantine's vision of this cultural universalism, one God, one emperor, one empire, and Constantine had proclaimed himself the protector of all Christians everywhere. So Christians in the Persian Empire originally said, oh goody, until they realized that Constantine did not have the political clout to make it happen. And so it takes them a few decades, but a century, within a century, they've that's partly, incidentally, why the Persian church went Nestorian. We'll talk about the Nestorian controversy later, but part of the reason why is so that they could distance themselves from Rome.
That's in the 400s.
Yes. In the 400s, it's actually right about this time that as Gobazes is seeking Roman patronage, Persian Christians are bailing out and saying, we don't want Roman patronage because that creates conflicts for us in the Persian Empire. It's also at this time, 470s, that the Western Empire is not much of an empire anymore. In fact, by 476, there is no Western Emperor. We'll talk about the alleged barbarian invasions later. Suffice it to say that the barbarian invasions largely consisted of the Roman army getting tired of not getting paid. Because part of it was the Roman army was a largely barbarian army by this time. And so it's true that they were barbarians, but they were largely barbarians who had been having dealings with Rome for a couple centuries by this point. So the idea that somehow after the sack of Rome the Dark Ages suddenly fell, by the year 600 there has been some very slow gradual change, but by the year 600 the main difference in the year 600 from the year 400 is that in the year 600 the ruler of Italy is not recognized as an emperor. The difference between what he was in 600 and what he was in 400, not huge. There are more rulers. It's been divided up. It's not under a unified government. But in terms of when you look at the writings of Gregory the Great, when you look at Venantius Fortunatus and other writers, there's not a huge transformation. It's a more slow, gradual transformation, and Dark Ages is simply not the right word for it. But part of it is, in the East, they're not as concerned about what's happening over there. Justinian, in the 6th century, will try to reconquer the West, which is just an absolute brilliant success and absolutely horrible tragedy for the Roman Empire. Because, on the one hand, Justinian, in the 6th century, is able to reconquer North Africa very quickly and easily. He's able to conquer Italy very slowly and painfully and at great expense. He's involved in the most comprehensive legal reform in Roman history. He's involved in one of the biggest building projects in Roman history. And where the heck is he getting all the money for this? He's stretching his troops thinner and thinner until finally the Roman Empire cannot withstand the invasion of the Persians. And in around 600, whatever 600, the Persian Empire invades and takes over Antioch once again, and down into Egypt, and then turns around and by 626 is knocking on the doors of Constantinople, which. You know, basically, when Constantine moved the seat of his empire from Milan to Constantinople, it was because he was concerned with the Persian threat. It's because Persia mattered more. Pretty much every emperor until Justinian had recognized Persia is the real threat. We don't care what's happening in the West. In the West, first of all, they're all Christians. Yeah, some of them are Arians. But quite frankly, by the time you get to Justinian, most of the Arians have been sort of converting over to Nicene Orthodoxy. So, you know, they're largely Christian barbarians. And they're barbarians, what more, who they're not trying to turn Rome into a barbarian state. They're trying to simply take over the Roman state and rule the Roman state because they like Rome better than whatever it was they had before. So really, the Eastern Empire, for the most part, was not concerned about the West because it didn't matter. It wasn't a real threat. Persia is the real threat. And the reason why Justinian had turned to the West was because he had established the eternal peace with Persia, which lasted for 8 years. he thought, in the way you conducted politics, the way the Roman emperors largely handled their enemies surrounding them was by buying them off, which may seem like a really lousy way of doing things, but it's cheaper to send them 500 pounds of gold every year than to spend the 1,000 or 2,000 pounds of gold in raising an army and attacking them at great loss and the politics at home. So it's cheaper to buy them off, and so you have all, and that's the way you handle most of your enemies. Persia did not take kindly to. They thought that Justinian had meddled too much in Armenia. Armenia is always the conflict between Persia and Rome, and so the Persian sweep in which finally in 626 is knocking on the gates of Constantinople, and in 626 Heraclius, the emperor. This is now, 60 years after the death of Justinian. Heraclius, in a bold move, as the Persian troops are coming across Turkey, leaves Constantinople. He spends a couple of years in Cappadocia preparing his troops for an invasion of Persia. At a time when Persia controls Egypt, Antioch, Judea, and is coming across Turkey, it's a bold strategy. But Heraclius leaves Constantinople to the navy, which, you know, when you've got a city that's surrounded on three sides by water, navy's not a bad idea. Brings the main bulk of his forces into the very heart of the Persian Empire, takes Ctesiphon, the Persian capital, by 628 has completely cut off the Persian threat. 628. What else is happening in 628? Yeah. As Persia is taking over the Roman world, and as Rome is taking over the Persian world, meanwhile, back at the ranch, down in Arabia, Muhammad has solidified his control over the Arabian tribes after enduring, basically, the only time Islam ever suffered was in the personal experience of Muhammad for 20 years before his triumph at Medina. because from the time that he, from 622 to 632, he unifies the Arabian Peninsula, and quite frankly, from 632 to 644, when his followers, after his death, take the whole Middle East, neither the Romans nor the Persians have the faintest idea what's going on. They're used to dealing with the Arabs. The Arabs have been around for centuries. The way you deal with the Arabs is by buying them off. You give them favors, you give them privileges, you give them titles, you give them money. And they're constantly trying to bargain with these Arabs who come knocking at their door. And it doesn't work. And they can't figure out why. And by the time they figured out why, it's too late. Because by 700, within two generations of Muhammad's death, the Islamic Empire has completely... Now remember, it was the Romans who undermined the Persian Empire and weakened it, so that there was really nothing left for Islam to wipe out. But you know, Islam takes over all of the Iranian plateau. Then they send their forces across North Africa and find very little resistance. Thank you, Justinian, for taking out any resistance the couple generations before in North Africa. And find themselves all the way into Spain within a few decades. And then they launch a series of attacks against Constantinople and wind up taking a fair part of Turkey. And before you know it, you have an Islamic empire that is the largest empire. It's the first time since Cyrus that anybody has ever managed to control this whole region. And for 200 years, there's not a threat. There's no outside threat to the Islamic empire. Constantinople, they're cornered on the Bosporus. And basically, Constantinople is not a threat. There's no serious challenge to Islamic rule. There's an internal split between the Umayyads and the Abbasids. The Umayyads are exiled. They take up their residence in Spain. But basically, for nearly 200 years, I guess it's only 150 years after that, the Abbasid dynasty is firmly ensconced in their new capital, Baghdad. And it's interesting. Constantine, when he wanted a Christian capital, had established Constantinople as a Christian city that would be, because Rome was simply too pagan, don't even bother trying to reform it. So he takes the old city of Byzantium, rebuilds it, remakes it into Constantinople. When the Abbasids, they quickly realize that there's no suitable capital for an Islamic empire, so they build the city of Baghdad out of nothing on the banks of the Euphrates. Not the Euphrates, the Tigris. Whichever one it is. So Baghdad, and it's one of the most impressive building programs in human history. So basically, and one of the brilliant strategies of the early Islamic Empire is that they do not. I mean, they successfully set up a cultural universalism that is not it's not especially missionary or evangelistic in its nature. They are not trying to convert Christians and Jews. In fact, Muslim rulers have special incentives not to try to convert them. Do you know what that special incentive is? Yep. They pay taxes. Christians and Jews pay taxes. If they convert to Islam, they don't have to pay taxes anymore. Because it is against Islamic law to tax a fellow Muslim. It's against the Quran. So, therefore, it's a brilliant strategy because it basically says, you know, of course, obviously, if you try to convert a Muslim, death. But there's very little indication of mass conversion. In fact, there are not mass conversions to Islam for 200 years. For 200 years, the Christian churches throughout the region hunker down. The thing is, since everybody's a Christian, it's not like there's a big evangelistic strategy anyway. I mean, pretty much the whole region, there are pockets of the old paganism, which they quickly rename themselves Sabians, since Muhammad in the Quran refers to the peoples of the book as Christians, Jews, and Sabians. And I'm not quite sure what Sabians are, but basically, polytheists who want to be protected call themselves Sabians. I'm a Sabian! The Sabians are also allowed to continue. The Christian church continues more or less peacefully under Islamic rule. But really what gets interesting is the places where Islamic rule never quite takes control. Armenia. The Armenian church remains, basically Armenia remains a Christian pocket. And then far in the south, Ethiopia, which interestingly are Monophysite territories that had never been part of the Roman Empire. And we'll talk about that. But that was actually part of the Roman Empire's strategy had been to try to keep against Persia, try to keep buffer zones in the north, Armenia, in the south, Ethiopia. These were the keys to holding off the Persian Empire, and actually in the south, Ethiopia is also a key for keeping the trade route open to India. And so Rome oftentimes tried to get more power, and that's where you often wonder, did they become Monophysite simply because they didn't want to be too much under the thumb of Rome, and Chalcedonian Orthodoxy was the cultural universalism of the Roman Empire? One would hope that people don't do things for simply political reasons, but certainly that seems to be seems to have been a significant factor. I'm skimming over huge amounts of. I really did want to get in the class this morning. I didn't quite finish with the all the Islamic stuff. But I do have in there on the number 6, Islam, World Empire, then Commonwealth, towards the probably the last page, the next to the last page. There's an inscription at the Dome of the Rock from 691 in Jerusalem, which incidentally this inscription is not visible from the ground, so not quite sure who they were expecting to read it, but it's not so much that everybody was reading it, but it's more that it's a very early witness to what the very earliest generations of Muslims were thinking about their Christian and Jewish neighbors, particularly Christians. But this inscription, O ye people of the book, overstep not bounds in your religion, and of God speak only truth. The Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, is only an apostle of God, and his word which he conveyed into Mary, and a spirit proceeding from him. Believe therefore in God and in his apostles, and say not three. It will be better for you. God is only one God, far be it from his glory that he should have a son. He is whatever is in the, his is whatever is in the heavens and whatever is on the earth. God witnesses that there is no God but he. And the angels and men endowed with knowledge, established in righteousness, proclaim there is no God but he. The mighty, the wise, the true religion with God is Islam. And one of the remarkable things I said earlier, Islam has never suffered. They have never been persecuted. It's again, sure, perhaps out in the fringes. You've had there have been issues in India and other places with or other, but Islam is not is a religion of conquest, and it also has, at least it took a lot longer for heresy to become a major problem in Islam. In one sense, Christianity was not well designed to become the sort of the religion of a universal empire. Christianity is a little bit too introspective, has too strong a doctrine of sin, causes you to question yourself. Not something that Islam tends towards. But that's also where the caliph in Islamic thought, the caliph has final religious and political authority. And so, in that sense, the issue of heresy, you really don't have as much of a problem until the 9th century, when after 200 years of this massive and a very impressive empire, the Islamic world divides into numerous caliphates, with each of their own caliph claiming to be the final authority for all matters political and religious. One comment Fowden makes is that whereas Christianity had far outstripped Rome's imperial impetus, the Islamic Empire had never left the religion of Islam to fend for itself. The sword had everywhere been at the service of the Quran, even if it had more often been wielded to defend than to impose the new faith. So it's not that you have to convert or die, but rather, if you attack the faith, then you die. And Fowden also comments that Islam today provides, along with, but often more self-confidently than Christianity, clear proof that the difficult late antique marriage of political and religious universalism, the Emperor Constantine's greatest vision and legacy, still endures.
I've heard it said that Christianity does not know how to be a majority religion, and Islam does not know how to be a minority religion.
Yeah, that's well, I think an awful lot of it has to do with that Christianity begins at the cross. It begins in suffering, and and that's where whereas that really there is no place for that in Islam. So, but any. I realize that's just an awful lot of material for one evening. But don't worry, and I'll spend the next like 6 weeks unpacking that. Parts of it. We'll get into all. Oh, yes. And that's where, just to then come back to the syllabus. I don't know if there are any other copies of it floating around. So, I have given you pretty much everything on here that I'm giving to the seminarians. Not so much that I'm expecting you to read all of it, as much as I couldn't immediately think of what to cut out. What we'll be doing next time is, and I think probably what I'm going to try to do is simply go from week to week, recommending what to do next in terms of what your focus should be on. Next time, I would, if you only have time to read, say, 25 pages, I would suggest The Martyrdom of Polycarp. The thing is, First Clement, it might just be worth your while just to read First Clement. The thing is, in a sense, I'd say pick what you like, because we'll be talking about all of it. And so if some of you read some of it and some of you read some other things and people bring different comments to the table, that's fine. ECF refers to the early church fathers. It's Cyril Richardson has edited it. It's one of the, basically all of the books on the, I found for book, at bookfinder.com for $5 to $20 each. Many of them you can find online. And that's where, if you want to print them off from the internet.
Newadvent.org has a ton of ton of readings from fathers.
Plus, the Christian Classics Theory Library has the older set of early church fathers books.
Right, and in some cases, New Advent has the same translations on them. New Advent oftentimes has them in a slightly easier to print out format than CCEL, but CCEL certainly has many of them. If you have any questions about how to get a hold of any of these books, let me know. I will say, when we get to Augustine's Confessions, you really need the New City Press edition. It's worth getting, regardless. It's just that much better a translation than anything else out there. Yes, that's the translation. In the class a few years ago, I taught a class on Augustine's Confessions, and that was the translation we used. So pretty much everything can be found online in some translation or other. I'm not sure the Augustine's monastic rules can be found there. I do have a hard copy of the course pack If you want to make copies of particular things, I have one copy here. So if there's something in particular you're looking for, but just to give you a brief brief sort of, if you don't know what to read and have no idea what any of this stuff is. First Clement is a letter from Clement, who some people argue was the Bishop of Rome. He doesn't identify himself as such, but it's from the Church of Rome to the Church in Corinth. And it's a follow-up letter to 1 and 2 Corinthians. A generation later, Clement is writing to the church in Corinth, basically saying, you know, guys, you haven't quite got it yet. you've got some of the same issues that Paul talked to you about. It's obvious that he's read 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. And so there are new issues, but I mean, you can see he's definitely thinking, you know, a generation later, you should have gotten it by now. It's really just it's a great read for seeing for a whole host of issues. Ignatius, I've given three of or four of his letters to the Ephesians, to the Romans, to the Smyrnaeans, to the Polycarp. You could obviously read more Ignatius, but with Ignatius, you read three or four of his letters, and there's only seven of them, but he says many of the same sorts of things repeatedly. But he's Ignatius was he had been condemned to death and was being sent to Rome to be executed, and so he's writing letters to. At first, he's writing letters to churches that he's going to. Then later, he's writing letters to churches where he had been visiting, and one of the things you'll notice is that people are visiting him and talking to him. If this was a persecution of all Christians, why on earth would Christians be coming to sit and talk with him, and why would he be writing letters to them? It was a targeted persecution going after certain individuals, and they really didn't care that other people. I mean, it's sort of like when Paul is imprisoned and on his way. I mean, they don't care. It's an imperial matter. The martyrdom of Polycarp is one of the first martyrdom accounts of the death of a Christian bishop in a persecution, and as such, it was written by his church in Smyrna to basically let other Christians know, Polycarp was faithful even to death, you should be too. Then the Didache is an early Christian manual of basically laying out the Christian life and worship. So that's basically, if there's something there that catches your fancy. What we'll do tonight was an awful lot of me talking because you hadn't read anything yet. Next time, we'll be getting into these texts, talking about them. I can provide some context. That's where, one of the. If there's no secondary source, then you're stuck with me providing you with context. But also, if you do get the Early Christian Fathers edition, there are some very nice introductions to these texts, and they can be helpful. One thing I'm having my students at Mars do, which you may just find this useful to do, is writing a basic summary of the argument of the reading. Obviously, I'm not grading you on this. But the thing is, what I told them is, I said, the reason I'm giving this assignment is for your future ministry, because if you are taking notes and basically laying out, here's the argument of First Clement, then 10, 20 years from now, when somebody from the congregation asks you a question, and you're like, you know, there was something in, I thought there was something I read in patristic history, but I have no idea what it was. Well, if you have it on your computer, then you don't have to go digging through all the readings and try to figure out what was it, where was this. So I said basically this is an assignment which is, it's basically designed for your future, and it's a good way of and I've just found this has become second nature to me in practically everything I read, and it's just a very useful way of keeping track of what you've read If you haven't done this sort of thing before, when you're reading a book, there are really two things you need to be doing. Oftentimes we just read a book for what the author is saying. But equally important is trying to understand, what is the author doing? Now what's the difference between what an author is saying and what an author is doing? took you a little while to figure this one out. What's the difference?
What Arthur's doing is, what effect does he intend his work to have on people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly part of it, yeah. Because, for instance, if you read the Book of Judges, just for what the author's saying, you'll come off with, you know, he's telling the story of the judges. And, boy, wasn't that a really miserable time. But what is the author doing in the Book of Judges? And that's where, as you come to understand what an author is doing in a book, you part of it is you understand what he's saying better. You also can start reading faster. Because once you understand what an author is trying to do, then you can almost anticipate what he's going to say next, because you see where he's going. The thing is, it takes time. I found when I first started trying to reading this way, it actually slows you down a little bit at first. But then over time, as you start thinking, just approaching reading with an eye towards, okay, what's happening? What is the author trying to do here? And you don't need huge. And this is where eventually you don't need huge amounts of outside information. I mean, obviously it helps to know what time period was he writing in, what were some of the circumstances. But really, sometimes the internal clues of what you're reading tells you everything you need to know. But I realize it takes time to get to that point. But it's a useful way of going about. It's a useful way of disciplining yourself in reading. To think about what is not just what is the author saying in the written assignment. That's oftentimes what you do. You know, sort of, okay, here's the argument here, and then you start seeing, okay, where's he going with this? What's he trying to accomplish? What's his purpose? And that's where sometimes it can be make a big difference in the effect of what you're reading. So, any questions or? I'm sorry? Oh, yes.
So, for example, is this early church father's book, is that online?
No, I don't think the book is online. Actually, everything in the book, I think, can be found online.
The individual pieces.
Right.
All the pieces there, for the first comment, that would be the entire book.
Mm-hmm.
So you've listed all the pieces there that we just have to look up in whatever online resources we have.
Right. So if you do look it up online, you'd basically just look for first comment. You'd look for Ignatius to the Ephesians, Romans, Smyrnaeans, and Polycarp.
Okay.
And I think.
Okay. So the next week, those course pack.
Right, Irenaeus is, and that's where, I have one copy of that, but that could be.
How many pages in the course pack?
This is the patristic side. The medieval side is the other half.
A trip down to Kinko's then.
So it would be. I mean, it probably wouldn't be too bad to stick it in the copier and, you know, let it run at some point. But that's the nice thing about having secretaries at Mid-America. They did all that for me. So, but I couldn't quite ask them to copy everything for you. Actually, that's where the Irenaeus section here comes entirely from the same. It's exactly the same as on the CCEL page. Actually, the Melito on Paschka and the Origin First Principles Book 4 might be the tough ones. Maybe.
I found the Melito on the Kerouac site.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. It's not. Yes. Good point. So Origins First Principles might be the toughest one to find.
If you David could send around some of the resources, you know, just links to some of the resources that would be handy.
Yeah.
Research
doesn't immediately pull it.
Yeah. So. Yeah, but I think. And Maximus Opuscules will be impossible to find online. So I can make copies of that for.
Okay.
And so that's. So. All right. Well, let's close with a word of prayer. Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, we do thank you that our Lord Jesus Christ has been enthroned as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and that indeed he does rule over all things as your beloved Son. And we ask, O Lord, that you would grant us the grace that we might walk before you as your servants, that we might live as your children, as those who are called out of darkness into light, that we might shine forth in the midst of the darkness and be your witnesses to the ends of the earth. And we pray, O Lord, that you would have mercy upon rulers in all nations, that they might not be proud and arrogant and seek their own glory, but that they would indeed humble themselves and acknowledge that Jesus is King, and accept the place that you have given them in this world as your servants. And we pray, O Lord, that you would help us to be a place where those who have been beaten up by the world, the flesh and the devil, would be able to find rest, that we might be a place where your mercy and charity is shown, that we would shine in the midst of the darkness, and that we would be showing mercy and compassion to those around us. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.